Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today, we'll hear about a program that provides help to people who sometimes have difficulty paying their heating bills. The Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program helps keep families safe and healthy in the winter months. Also, we hear about a new musical event this weekend to benefit Lamb Theater. But first, we take a look at what to expect with the 2020 U.S. Census. The U.S. Census takes place on April 1st. That census counts every person living in the 50 states, the District of Columbia, and the five U.S. territories. This Saturday, the League of Women Voters of Sioux City is sponsoring an event at the Sioux City Public Museum where you can learn about the census and find out what you can expect. Dagma Simmons and Aaron Berzina are with the League. Berzina says the event at the museum will answer some basic questions about the census.
The focus of the Census 2020 talk on February 22nd is to give a basic overview of what our census is, the timeline, when people should expect to be contacted, what the questions are going to be. Just some general information for the public so they are very well prepared for count day, which is April 1st.
So what will happen on April 1st? Are people actually going to be, are they going to call? Or are they going to come around door to door? Because when I was a kid, people would come around door to door.
Sure. This year is a little bit different. For the first time, the 2020 census is going to be delivered online. You can respond online, by phone, or eventually you will get a paper questionnaire in the mail. So the actual outreach has been going on probably for the last year or so, but the online portal will actually open on March 12th. So people can begin to respond on March 12th, and at that time, people will be getting a postcard mailed to them with some information on how to fill out your census online. That really is the primary push this year to for those who are able and willing to respond online. Now, the option to respond by phone affords people the opportunity to respond in 13 different languages. Which is a wonderful addition this year to the census. You can also request glossaries that are available in 59 different languages, just to give people a better opportunity to respond.
So it's a lot more diverse now.
Yes. They really are making, the United States Census Bureau is making a very concerted effort to reach out to those populations who have been historically undercounted.
Why is it so important to get an accurate count?
That has to do a lot with federal funding. There was a study by George Washington University called Counting for Dollars, and they are working in partnership with the U.S. Census to figure out how much funding is provided in different federal programs. The latest data is determines that over 316 federal programs, $1.5 trillion in federal funding is distributed among the communities. So each response matters. The most recent estimate, to give an example, each Iowan not counted in the U.S. Census, it's estimated that the state loses $4,400 each year for 10 years in those 316 federal programs for one Iowan. So to give, you know, to go a little farther with that example, if 100 people don't respond, let's say in Sioux City, to the 2020 census, over 10 years, that's $4.4 million in those 316 programs that don't come back to our community. That's part of why the outreach and, you know, the efforts made by both the local Complete Count Committee, we have a state Complete Count Committee, and the federal government. That's why these efforts have been made and are so vitally important.
I know some people say they're afraid to take part in the census. They're worried about what's going to be done with their personal information, what the government will do.
Right. That is confidentiality and security have been two things that have had, you know, have been discussed at great lengths in communities and by the government. First, I want to stress that this was announced a long time ago, but there are still people that don't know that there is no citizenship question on the 2020 census. I think that's still very important to convey to the public. But as far as internet safety, the online portal portion is safe. It is guarded by the same safeguards that the Department of Homeland Security uses, that different federal agencies use. It's cutting edge. It's very much protected. Once a person responds online, the actual information is stored immediately on secured government servers. It is not out there for people to get. And kind of on the other side of that, census data that is gathered by the U.S. Census Bureau and the Department of Commerce cannot, by federal law, be shared with any other government department. So that includes Department of Homeland Security and ICE and even your local enforcement departments. So there is some, you know, getting that information out to the public that this information can't be shared. A person can go to prison for 5 years and have a $250,000 fine if a census employee were to share that information. We all sign confidentiality oaths. I am not a census employee, and I still had to sign a confidentiality oath. So it's something that the Bureau takes very seriously as well. It's really the data that matters. It is who lives, how many people live in a community, and what kind of housing, things that can help our community or help the federal government know exactly what money should go where.
And so this event on Saturday, you're going to be explaining how the census is going to work and sort of inviting people to come down and also have some pie.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
And just to point out that the League of Women Voters logo on this is called Help Us Get Our Piece of the Pie. That's why we're serving pie.
And it is really important that our community gets our fair share. This is our fair share. This is money that we can use right here locally, and everybody can do their part just by filling out a piece of paper. It's 9 questions.
That was Dagma Simmons and Erin Berzina of the League of Women Voters of Sioux City talking about the 2020 Census Informational Meeting this Saturday, February 22nd, at the Sioux City Public Museum. That event follows a legislative town hall at the museum with local state lawmakers. And then at 11:30, the census event will begin. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Rural school districts often have a hard time competing for state and local funding. The 2020 Grow Rural Education Program provides Iowa farmers an opportunity to nominate their local rural public school district for a $15,000 grant to enhance science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM, education. Erin Glarner does outreach for the Bear Fund, which sponsors the program.
So the way the program works is that a farmer will nominate their local eligible local public school district of choice. They can nominate one school district per farmer.
And was this started in a way because sometimes rural schools just have a hard time getting all the resources they need?
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, when we think about STEM initiatives, which is a combination of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, we are seeing quite an influx of jobs available in that area. But unfortunately, a lot of schools, and rural schools in particular, don't have the technology resources in the classrooms to best equip students to be prepared for those types of fields. So we're trying to get resources and projects in place that will both gauge interest at a young age, but then also provide the hands-on learning opportunities that students can have to best prepare them for those types of fields of study in the future.
I know one of the schools was here in Iowa, right?
Yes. So we've had several winners. I can tell you historically, since the program started, Iowa has been awarded $1.2 million of grant money from our program. And last year alone, Iowa received about $115,000 worth of grant money from this program. Yeah. So since the program started, we've given away over $18 million to more than 1,000 rural public school districts throughout the United States.
farmers, people in rural areas, they can nominate a school. What do they need to do that?
So they can do it one of two ways. So they can visit our website and complete a very short nomination form, or they can call the toll-free number. For the farmer, the process takes less than 5 minutes to complete. So those are the two different ways in which a farmer can do the nomination. And like I said, they have from now until April 1st. To nominate a school district. So it's a school district, not just an individual school. And then they can nominate one school district of their choice. And then the school district then has the opportunity to submit a grant application.
Could you talk about some of the projects that have come out of this? There are some very interesting things that schools are doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So a couple of examples. One, actually, out of the state of Iowa, just 2 years ago, an old locker room was transformed into a monarch butterfly incubation room. And so the school room purchased the equipment needed to raise butterflies throughout their life cycle. And this was targeted for kids K through sixth grade. And so what they did is they raised the butterflies throughout their life cycle. They tagged and released the butterflies and then were able to look at the survival rates. And apparently that individual school alone, out of 60 classrooms in more than 20 schools, had the highest survival rate of monarch butterflies. And so now they are partnering with other school districts and other agencies to kind of help support the monarch butterfly. So that's one very cool story. Another success story out of the program was a middle school actually in the state of Illinois spent an entire year designing and building a prosthetic arm for a farmer who had unfortunately lost his arm in a farming accident. So that's just an amazing success story that came out of it. But I can tell you other projects that we have funded or looking to fund, again, anything that supports STEM initiatives. So greenhouses are a really big project that we've supported, either overhauling an existing greenhouse or building a new greenhouse, updating of science and laboratory equipment. We've also, 3D printers, maker spaces are very popular. And I would say in the last couple years, we're also seeing a lot of requests for like welding and shop equipment because a lot of students are pursuing more trade focused jobs in the future, not just a 4-year traditional university. So those are kind of like the different areas that we look to support. But anything that a teacher can think of that supports science, technology, engineering, or math are the types of projects that we're looking to fund.
That was Erin Glarner with the Bear Fund, which sponsors the 2020 Grow Rural Education Program. Iowa farmers can nominate school districts for the $15,000 grant that will fund STEM programs. And they can do that through April 1st. For information, go to AmericanFarmers.com. Support for The Exchange comes from Gregory Giles, investment advisor representative with Legacy Financial, LLC in Sioux City, serving the financial planning and investment needs of clients since 2004. Information about Legacy Financial and Greg Giles is available at LegacyFinancialLLC.com. Financial planning and advisory services offered through RDA Financial Network. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. Spring arrives in 1 month, but many in Siouxland still have problems dealing with the financial side of winter. The Community Action Agency of Siouxland offers a special program to keep people warm during this cold season. The executive director of the group, Jean Logan, tells Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer about LIHEAP and more.
It's called the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program. Leave it to the federal government, never to have like just a few short words there. But when people call in, they'll say the Energy Assistance Program. I mean, you can call it help with your utilities, really anything. But the short form officially is LIHEAP. And it is a federal program that's available in all the states, all the counties. Each state has its own state plan that it puts in. And what it's designed to do is to really help pay a portion of the winter heating bills.
Now, I know, you know, we all think spring's just around the corner, but this program is still available.
Yeah. You know, it's nice. It really goes the full length of winter. So in October, it's for people that would be considered automatically eligible, seniors, people with disabilities. And then it really starts off for everybody that would income qualify November 1st and runs through April 30th. So if you've already received funding from the Energy Assistance Program, it's a one-time thing, the winter heating season. But that length of the program helps a lot of people who you might have gotten sick, might have lost a job. We look at the last 30 days of your income. So throughout the winter, that might be you.
That's true. And what are some of the guidelines? Like, give maybe an example. If you're a single person, how much money in that 30-day period or for the year would you have to fall under?
Yeah, we can look at last year's tax returns or the past 30 days. So for a single household, that would be $21,858. For a family of four, it's $45,063 and under would qualify.
And if people are listening and they think, well, you know, I don't know if I want to do this program, it's available. I mean, it's a federal benefit.
It is a federal benefit program. So it really, if you are eligible and you don't apply, you really have just left that money on the table. Our average award amounts this year are $465. So you're walking away from a lot of federal money that's really offered to you because of your financial situation. And that benefits our community. You know, I like to think of it, that's a pretty good sized chunk of money you could buy. If you're not paying utilities, you can pick up groceries. You could maybe pay off a bill that you have. For some people, it really is a choice between prescription medication and paying that utility bill. In those cases, it's critical that you come in and apply for this program. You're entitled to this.
And you've been doing your job for over 20 years. Are you seeing a bigger need for a program like LIHEAP than in years past, or what kind of trends are you seeing?
But right now, I would say we're running about where we usually do in terms of applications. We've helped over 2,100 households, but the census data would tell me that there's probably 2,600 to 2,800 households out there that we're not reaching. So I know there are still people that would be eligible. And that's why I really appreciate the opportunity to be talking with you, because, you know, you might have a neighbor, a friend. It might be you as a working household. You might qualify.
Are there certain areas of the population who maybe don't know about this program, or you think you were talking about the census information, but what kind of areas of the population do you think could benefit by knowing more about this program to know that it's available?
Well, I think we have a lot of people that think the only way that I could get any help as if I have a shutoff notice. That's not true. This is a benefit that's available to you even if you don't have shutoff notice. So that's one myth buster. The other one is if you have someone that's undocumented in your household, your family can still be eligible for this assistance. And how that would work, we need all the family income for the household, but say dad's undocumented and mom and two children are not, and they income qualify together, they would prorate the share of energy assistance to that household. So I think a lot of people may have somebody undocumented in their household that would think, I'm not eligible, but they would be.
They would be. And you were talking about $400+. Is that for the whole season, or is that for a month, or is that throughout the whole winter?
Yeah, that's a one-time payment.
One-time payment, okay.
Throughout the winter. And how it would work for most people is, you know, most of us have Mid-American. So, or maybe you deal with the propane vendor. So we would send that credit. It just shows up at a credit on your account. And so that's why we need a lot of information. We need to know who your utility vendor is. And we ask information like the size of your household is, and we need birth dates for your family members, because as a federal program, we're required to verify a lot of information.
And it's a kind of a program, too, if you don't use it, if this area doesn't use it, you just, like you said, it's money on the table that you lose.
That's correct. I think we've been really good. You know, they allocate by county what they expect everyone to use. And so there's been more than once that because I think we've done a good job, we've actually requested funding from that's come from other parts of the state kind of, you know, to help people here. So it's always good for us to use whatever federal money is available. I think Western Iowa, we kind of feel left out in that way anyway.
Yeah, I think you know, sometimes really. We do with the politics, you know, the center of the state, Des Moines, and then we're kind of up here on our own. I think you're correct when you say that.
So one of the exciting things that I'd like to tell you about is that there's 17 community action agencies that cover all 99 counties. We were one of four, and we serve Woodbury County for this program. So if somebody's listening out there and they think, well, I live in Plymouth, what about me? You can still call the Community Action Agency and we'll get you the number for who in Nebraska, South Dakota, or one of the other Iowa counties.
This.
Yeah, we'll help you figure out where you need to go to apply. But we have the opportunity to do online.
Oh, so just do it that way. Okay.
You know, a lot of people have, you have your phone, so you can like click, here's my wage information, click your Social Security card, click, send us that. So you can apply in your pajamas at 2 o'clock in the morning if you want to.
You know, it's really hard when there are people who have to make the really tough decisions. Do you turn the power on or do you put food on the table?
There are a lot of people that this winter, they're living in two rooms of their home with blankets up and they've shut all the vents off and they're just barely trying to heat things. I mean, this program is to help alleviate some of those terrible effects that poverty can bring to bear. And at the agency, at the Community Action Agency, you know, we do have a food pantry. If you call and make an appointment, we'll tell you all of the things that you need to bring in for this program. But we can also talk to you about all the other great programs that the Community Action Agency offers. We have, you know, Head Start, Early Head Start, that can help with childcare. We've got some other emergency assistance programs that people might be able to avail themselves to. So really, this is a nice way maybe to find out what is out there that might also be able to help you. People suffer in silence, and I hate that here's this program, and it was designed for you, to help you, and people they're reluctant to apply.
That's Jean Logan with the Community Action Agency of Siouxland. For more on the LIHEAP program, you can check out the website caasiouxland.org. Listening to The Exchange, I'm Mary Hartnett. A special event is coming up this Saturday night for Lam Arts Regional Theater in Sioux City. Diana Woolley and Dave Madsen sat down with Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer to talk about the evolution of the theater in Sioux City.
Gosh, Lam Theater has been around for 40 years.
40 years, isn't that something? I mean, it amazes me at times.
And you have some big plans.
We do. We first started out where it was called the Hilton Hotel. It was downtown. And we stayed there for about 7 years. And then we moved over. Well, we didn't have a home for a year. And during that year, I got my master's. That was good thinking because I wouldn't have been able to afterwards. And then we moved over to the old Webster School building where we are right now at 417 Market. And we're hoping in the next couple years to be moving into 625 Douglas across from the Woodbury County Courthouse.
And how's the project coming along so far?
It's so exciting. It truly, every week we have a meeting with our developers every Wednesday morning, and it's exciting how many things are happening and how it's I'm learning a lot, and it's a good thing I'm so young.
Yeah, I was going to say, right. 40 years, you barely look 40 yourself now.
Oh, that's good.
There you go.
Like, she's now my favorite, David.
and Dave Madsen, you've been a big part of this theater as well.
Oh my gosh, yes.
My wife and I were in the second show that they did, 39 years ago, because we were in the second show that they did and have been a part of what they've been doing at the Hilton time and Market Street and all of that. Yeah. So it's exciting for us to see how this has come along for Russ and Diana originally as a business, but now as a nonprofit organization, to see what they're bringing to the community. That's just so exciting to see what they have been doing and what the plans are. I mean, if you can see I know this is radio, so you can't see the pictures, but the ideas of what's going to happen at this new facility downtown where KCAU used to be at 625 Douglas. If you can see those pictures, it's just amazing what the potential is that's going to happen down there.
It really is exciting. Two theaters and a cabaret bar and little theater. And the exterior will remain exactly as it did in 1909. I mean, we'll restore it back to what it looked like in 1909 because it doesn't look like that now.
Because it used to be a ballroom back in the day or an auditorium?
It started out as a First Sioux City auditorium, and then it was with one of the Legion's groups took it, and then it went to a ballroom.
The Tomba Ballroom.
And a lot of our older patrons have fond memories of their days at the Tomba.
Older than us.
Much older. Yeah. No, they're not that much older, David. And then KCAU came in.
And so KCAU had it for a lot of years then.
Oh, yeah.
And then when they moved to their new facility, then the space sat empty for a little while. And if you drive by down there, you can see that they've already started some of the work to pull off the fake outside that was there. And you can see what eventually is going to be really cool to see the exterior of this building.
We needed to find out for historic tax credits how much was left of the building. On the interior, there really isn't much left of the Sioux City Auditorium. But the exterior, there's a lot of potential still there. And so that's the route we're taking is to restore it back to what it looked like, which will be awesome right across the street from that beautiful Woodbury County Courthouse.
Yeah, that's a jewel for the community as well.
And then right behind where the new Lamb Theater will be is a really cool park area, and the Children's Museum, the launch pad is right there too. I mean, imagine what this whole area can be once Lamb is up and running there at 625 Douglas.
And I think what's kind of great about this area, people have so many opportunities to see theater. I'm really surprised.
True.
I mean, there's so many different companies.
Oh, absolutely.
And what you do is top-notch stuff.
Well, thank
so,
you. Yeah.
I mean, I think Sioux City is lucky to have that. And maybe some people don't realize, you know, what's going on right here in their own community.
It is exciting. And when we have people come in from outside or some of our playwrights that we've been working with and they come and see what we're doing, they really are amazed and they're very complimentary. And we've had people that have come in and helped out with lights or, you know, we've hired them to do lights and they're working in much bigger markets. And they're just amazed at our rehearsal technique and also the end product and our approach.
I mean, it's professional.
Everything.
I mean, it's...
We've always wanted it to be professional. Yeah. That it makes it exciting.
Do you have a favorite show you've done? I know people always see, I want to ask both of you, do you have a favorite show that you've done over the years with Lamb?
You know, every show.
Or you can name a few of them.
Yeah, every show I do, it's my favorite at the time.
At the time.
Which is good. It's good. There's some things that are very dark that I've enjoyed doing. and I love the musicals too.
It is hard to come up with
now
that.
Now, both of us have done Hello, Dolly.
We've done Hello, Dolly a couple of times.
Yeah.
Actually, three times. We've done it three times.
I think. Yeah. Not always playing opposite each other.
No, uh-uh. But that's really fun.
Yeah, and one of the times he stepped on my skirt and he stepped on my skirt as we were dancing and it fell off and all that was remaining were
your bloomers?
You must have petticoat or something. I don't remember. I've wiped that out of my memory.
And you just kept going like it was no big deal, right?
Yes, absolutely.
the true professional.
Oh, yeah. And we, right. we get in trouble sometimes because something will hit us both funny, and we do get in trouble sometimes.
We do. Yeah. We have been known to giggle when we're out.
Yeah. You mostly, were a little worried about doing this interview that you might do a lot of giggling.
And notice she is, but I'm not.
Oh, no, you're maintaining. That's so, good.
We just have a great time. I mean, you know, everybody, when you're doing theater, you have such a good time. Even if you're doing those darker shows,
yeah.
you're still having a good time because you're realizing I'm telling people a story. And the way you're getting to do that, even though it's dark, it's still interesting and fun for the actors, I think. And fun for the audience, too, even if it is a little bit of a darker kind of show.
Right. And you learn something about yourself in all of the shows that you're doing. You get to live vicariously through your characters. And so your life just becomes fuller. And I think that's the same thing that's true of people that see theater. Their life becomes fuller because they're able to put themselves, especially when where our theater is so intimate. When we go to those big Broadway shows, I've complained to Russ that, you know, sometimes I'm so far away, I feel so detached from what's going on.
And you really don't feel like that at all at LAM. And even in the new facility, it still is going to be a smaller theater so you can see the people.
Yeah.
You
know.
And you're actually getting ready for another sort of a production coming up.
Yeah. It is a production.
Soon.
In fact, on the way here, I thought of some more things that you will just love.
Oh, okay.
David.
So this is on Saturday night. Uh-huh. It's called Broadway Inside Out. So Saturday night, February 22nd, it's out at Country Celebrations Event Center here in Sioux City. And it's a fundraiser for that 625 Douglas project. And it's just, Diana's putting this show together. It's just a lot of fun. People will have a good time and help this project move along, the 625 Douglas.
And what kind of performances will people get a chance to see?
It's songs and scenes that are done in a different sort of way. And if I can't tell anything, I can tell afterwards. But I don't want to spoil it for the people that are
attending. Oh, it's supposed to be a big surprise.
Oh, my gosh.
It is kind of, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty fun.
It is more
than pretty fun.
Bruce Miller and I are the co-hosts.
Bruce Miller from The Journal,
From The Journal, right? As well as the morning meteorologist from KMEG TV will be there, too. And so it's just going to be a great evening for people. And you can find out more about that and find out about tickets at the website at lamtheater.com.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's fun.
Always good to see you. And we want to also thank you for teaming up with Siouxland Public Media. When we did the Christmas Carol.
Yes, we did.
That was a great.
That really was great. We just love K-Wit.
For more information on Broadway Inside Out, taking place this Saturday night in Sioux City, go to the website lamtheater.com. The Siouxland Home Show kicks off next Thursday at the Sioux City Convention Center. The executive officer of the Home Builders Association of Greater Siouxland, Terry Shelm, talked to Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer about this year's event, new trends, and the outlook for the industry in the region.
One of our exciting projects that we do and have been doing for several years is our Project Home that we partner with Western Iowa Tech. We're actually on our 19th year of partnership in building houses with the students. One of the other things that we're excited about that's coming up in April is our Build My Future. The industry is in such need of workforce that we felt this was a good partnership with industry and students, so we went to the schools. Last year we got about 500 students at our Build My Future event.
Wow.
And they did hands-on events, laying bricks, hanging sheetrock, so it gave them an opportunity to feel the building industry.
And what is the outlook for the building industry in Siouxland?
All of the trades are just in dire need. They cannot take as much business as they'd like because they don't have the workforce to take care of it.
So are there more trends? Are maybe people doing more remodeling or is there more building going on this area, would you say?
You can see both of that. If they, if they feel like they can't find a builder, maybe they would keep their home.
So you've been doing this partnership with Western Iowa Tech for a long time. How many different homes do you think you've worked on?
The partnership has been going for 19 years. Next year will be their 20th year. Right now, we partner with the carpentry class, the HVAC, and the electrical students. So it's a great partnership, and it gets really busy out at the house at certain times, depending on what's going on.
And do they usually do a house a year, or is it just an ongoing project?
It is just one house a year, and that's all that they can get the curriculum in with building a house. So they start at the beginning of the school year, and then by the end, they're typically done, and then we start over the next year.
And I know you've actually done a lot, too, to help veterans as well in the past with some of the home building projects.
We do. We do. We also have our organization called Projects for Patriots. And we've got a committee that's very involved in, you know, stepping in and helping remodel houses that they need help in that they can't afford. So, yeah, we do have an arm that does do that.
As well. And the home show is coming up very soon. And the thing I think if people, I know many people would like to build a new house, but if you know, a lot of people might actually go towards maybe remodeling what they have.
Right, right. So yeah, the show is coming up. We're excited to bring a variety of options. Like you said, if you want to just redo your back deck, that's an option. And then we've got the actual home builders, we've got somebody that can do remodeling. And this year we also tried to make sure that we brought in an electronic component. So we tried to bring in a few vendors that it seems like smart homes are kind of the trend.
Oh yeah, they are, aren't they?
So yeah, we're kind of excited that maybe that's a kind of a new twist. And the other thing is the convention center's got a kind of a new look. They've got a pre-function space that they added on.
Oh, I haven't checked it out.
Yeah, yeah. It's the area between the convention center and their new courtyard. So we've got additional booths coming into that space. Attendees will be able to come in from that entrance. Normally, we had them all come through the main doors. So you can come in that door, see some new vendors there. So I'm excited. It's going to have a new look this year.
Oh, that's good. So if this is kind of a tradition that you do to kind of kick off your spring. This is something that, an early spring anyway, they can see something new. And you pretty much, I know going in years past, there's really all different kinds of things, you know, from the outside of the home, your yard, all kinds of things.
Yes. And, you know, even if you're not even a homeowner, I still think you can come get ideas. There's a variety of things that maybe you're a renter and we try and tap into everybody. You know, maybe you want to just paint your walls. Maybe you don't own the house, but you could, you know, at least come up with a new color, a new trend. So all the vendors do a nice job of bringing in the newest and latest colors, and whether it be for the walls or the kitchens. And they also, I think, do a nice job of offering show discounts. So, you know, they kind of want to have you come out and buy something.
Buy something. That's true. So what kind of trends have you noticed over the years? How have things kind of evolved?
You know, I was just at the International Builder Show. And it's interesting to sit through some of those seminars. And, you know, I'm always listening because we partner with Project Home and we want to make sure that we're doing what's the coming. And one of the things that was they said is kind of here and is going to they expect to stay is white kitchen cupboards. So whether that's your liking or not, that's what the trends are showing. They also are seeing that the islands are very, you know, that's here to stay for a while.
That is. Okay, yep. That's been in for a little while. Yeah,
yep.
But it's going to stick around.
Yeah, yep. So kind of exciting.
That is, yeah. And that's kind of neat, too, because I know when we moved into our new house, my husband, every single surface you could see, he painted it white.
Okay.
And in everything, like we had maple woodwork and he's like, he does design for a living. So he's like, everything was white. And luckily we did have the white kitchen. But unfortunately, I always hate it when you have something that ends up being trendy.
Right. Right.
Something that you enjoy. It's even that with clothing, don't you think? Like you find something that you enjoy and it's your look. And, you know, if you like a certain style and then all of a sudden it becomes in. And to me, that's kind of disappointing because you enjoy
it. It'll age it.
Yeah. Like, yeah. You know, like 5-10 years, we'll say, oh, gosh, we have to paint everything a color now. Or now the maple woodwork is back. So.
Right. One of the colors that they're saying on cupboards is blue. That's the new trend.
Wait, what kind of, like a blue navy?
It's a darker blue.
Really?
Yeah.
Ooh, I don't know about that one.
I know. And I can't say I minded it. I saw a few options of it while I was out there, but so maybe that's the new look.
Maybe it is. Yeah. We'll have to come up with our own new trends maybe as well. Yeah. What would you say your favorite thing about the home show? What's the thing that you like the most? I know that's hard because, you know, kind of being in charge of it, you don't want to pick favorites. Is that?
It is. This is a behind the scenes thing that I need to share is We have a cookie room for our vendors, so you can they can get away and go have a cookie. We have the professional women in building that man the room and keep the cookies going. So that's kind of a secret that we love. But as far as for the showgoers, the neatest thing is this year we got a pretty neat grand prize coming in. It's going to be a granite picnic table. Boatman Tile designed it for us. And this thing is heavy, and it would be the coolest thing on your deck or your backyard. We've got a Traeger grill coming. And then along with that, we're throwing in a package of steaks. So doesn't that sound fun?
Yeah, that does.
Jazz up your backyard.
That's true. No, that's great. And you were talking, you know, you were talking about some women being involved. Do you think more women need to be in the field? Has that been changing at all?
You know, we do see, and around the area, we do see women in building. And whether it be actually out there swinging the hammers or the ones that are involved in laying out the blueprints, that's an avenue for this industry to tap into to help that workforce load. And I know they've seen girls coming through the carpentry programs too, so that's exciting.
You were telling me about all the things that you do beyond the home show with the Home Builders Association. You had the program with Western Iowa Tech. You had the home building for veterans. You actually also have more opportunities for students as well.
Right, right. We offer a high school student scholarship program. Professional Women in Building man this scholarship. Last year, we gave away $4,000 scholarships to local high school students going into the building industry. We do have a deadline coming up on that of March 27th. They can get that a scholarship application at our website. But we love to, we're always raising money for things like this. So we love when we get applicants that are, you know, wanting to go into this industry. That's what we're here for.
That's Terry Shum with the Home Builders Association of Greater Siouxland. For more information on the home show that runs from next Thursday to Sunday, check out SiouxlandHBA.com or the Facebook page for the Home Builders Association of Greater Siouxland. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. February is Black History Month, and a new book that tells the story of the experiences of African American slaves is now available. River of Blood, American Slavery from the People Who Lived It, is a new collection of the slave narratives. The collection of narratives includes photographs of the interviewees. Photographer and author Richard Kahan is one of the editors of the book. He says the stories were taken down and pictures taken in the 1930s as part of a Depression-era program with the Works Progress Administration.
Among the many projects they did, they interviewed 3,500 formerly enslaved men and women. And in the process, they photographed more than 300 of them. And this book is the first, as you mentioned, that combines the photographs and their excerpts of their testimony, of their interviews. I'm called now a photo historian, something that I never knew existed before I heard it. I'm really a journalist, but I do books based on photography. And I see that there's a great power between seeing a photograph of somebody and hearing their words.
It really does bring it home to me what life must have been like, because it was a lot closer to the actual events. I mean, they were still alive. They were children, obviously, at the time. This is the 1930s. And I was thinking about that and thinking, well, I was born in the 60s, and that was 100 years from the end of slavery. And now we're in 2020, and it just keeps receding.
When I've mentioned to people that there are photographs of people who were enslaved, they can't believe it. And there was something very special about these photographs. So they're very simple, but very powerful and beautiful. They were taken by the interviewers, that mostly white, mostly women, actually. And at the end of their long interviews, which usually lasted, it looks like about an hour, the interviewer would say, do you mind if I take your picture? And they would bring out a kind of a brownie camera, the camera of the day, and they took one or two shots, and they made prints. It looks like it was, you know, like drugstore prints, kind of like we amateurs did in those days. And those photographs were just attached to the transcripts by paperclips. They were almost an afterthought. But I think it's these photographs that bring these words alive, and I think it's the words that bring the photographs, make the photographs even stronger.
Most of the people who conducted these interviews were white people. I know at the time it wasn't thought of as much. Do you think it made a big difference in this case?
You know, we'll never know. We'll never know what the difference is. Adam Green, who's a University of Chicago historian who wrote the foreword of the book, called this collection a vexed and compromised collection, but he also calls it a revelatory collection. I find that most of these people spoke eloquently, and they spoke with great detail. They did not seem to be compromised as they talked. These people were all in their 70s, 80s, 90s, and a few were 100. So, you know, there wasn't going to be much, retribution to what they said. And they were saying it really for the Library of Congress. But on the other hand, it must have seemed so strange for a white person to all of a sudden knock on the door of their home and say, we value your words. We'd like to talk to you about your experience of slavery. That must have been one culture shock. But I think these people, these men and women, took advantage of it, knowing that it was such a unusual and important request that they obviously gave them time.
And the title is River of Blood, and there are several descriptions in here of not just punishments, but utter sadistic cruelty on the part of the owners. It's almost hard to, in the world we live in today, to visualize it. And if you can, you almost can't stand to think about it.
It's true. Slavery was based on terrorism, not just the concept of it, but day to day. If you picked extra cotton, you didn't get rewarded in any way. You didn't get any extra food. You didn't get any extra pay, or there was no pay. So the only way to encourage people to work hard was to terrorize them. And the terrorism was oftentimes public, so everybody could see it. And it was brutal. And it is overwhelming to see some of these very specific descriptions. But ultimately, I hope you found, and I hope our readers found, that this is really a book of persistence and resistance and real beauty. The love people had for their families and their determination to live on and tell their stories and live a life after slavery, I find to be remarkable. I think these people and all the men and women who were enslaved who were interviewed are true heroes of America.
They're really survivors of all this, aren't they?
They are. They are. They're stories of young boys watching their mothers being whipped and their father having their hand on their shoulder as if to say, don't make a move. You're not going to change anything. There are stories of people who couldn't take it anymore and who ran off. People who had mental problems. I think that's, but ultimately this is a book of victory, of people who as kids were very scarred, but this sounds cliche-ish, but who lived to tell about it.
There's also mention in the book about wiping away the kind of Gone with the Wind story or depiction of slavery as not really that bad and everyone got along.
Yeah, until this was done in the 30s, the prevailing story of slavery was mostly written by Southern historians. There's a very famous one by the name of Ulrich Phillips. And they used slave, basically they based their books on slave holder records. And when you look at someone's records, you see how much food was provided. You see that there were cabins built and shelter provided. And you get a remarkably jarring false narrative of what happened. And until this project happened, there were slave narratives. Frederick Douglass obviously wrote a very famous slave narrative, and Nat Turner narrative about what had happened. But this was such an important project because thousands of people were interviewed and they gave very, very consistent stories. It's taken a while for us to really value what people have to say.
We think about Thomas Jefferson, we think about George Washington, many of these people that are, you know, really the founders of our country, the people who created the world that we live in today and very much respected. But then you read this and you know they had slaves, and you know, no matter what some historians have said about them, they chased them down, they punished them, they sold them.
It's interesting. I live in Chicago, and I've written a lot about the Chicago 8 trial in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And people will recall that Abby Hoffman was one of the people that was on trial, and the judge was Julius J. Hoffman. And at one point, Abby Hoffman asked Judge Hoffman why he had pictures of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson over his bench. He said they were slaveholders. And at the time, it was dismissed. But now I think these are really good questions, and I think we're catching up to asking these hard questions and trying to understand this.
That was Richard Kahan, a photographer and editor of the latest collection of published slave narratives from the 1930s. It's called River of Blood, American Slavery from the People Who Lived It. It includes unflinching stories of what those African Americans went through when they were in slavery, and they also talk about what happened after they were freed. That's it for The Exchange this week. Thanks to Sheila Brummer. I'm Mary Hartnett. We'll see you next week.